Welcome once again to the Fleming Foundation Podcasts, and once again, we are doing those April birthdays, the final April birthdays, and starting this list, a real kicker. Oh, by the way, the guy sitting next to me, Dr. Thomas Fleming, there he is.
Hello, Rex.
Hi, Doc. The great, great Ella Fitzgerald. On the 25th, 1917, and what a voice, eh?
Can you tell me one song Ella Fitzgerald sang and made famous?
I don't know, but every time I hear her voice, I recognize it.
Yes, it's a very recognizable voice.
Oh, I got one. It's in Agata Davida. Didn't she do that entire album?
Almost, yes. You're very close. It was a long time since Ella had been a maiden. She'd grown up fairly tough, even had to hit the streets as a girl, argued with her family. She developed an incredible voice. Later on in life, she listened to her early recordings, like her great recording of A Tisket, A Tasket. And she said, well, I sound like a little girl. And yes, she does. But what a little girl. Mm-hmm. That is, her vocal control was stupendous. Her ability to either put over a song just by singing it straight, as she did in albums she did late in life, where she was recording the Great American Songbook, all George Gershwin or Rodgers and Hart or Cole Porter. These are wonderful, but she was also a great jazz singer, meaning she's a great jazz musician. Her scat singing is phenomenal.
I thought scat was a word that you wouldn't use. I thought it had a technical term, but scatting, that's what I remember. I remember seeing old recordings where she's just kind of... Man, intonation, the notes are perfect.
Yeah, she's a musician. The only person I can say who rivals Ella Fitzgerald in that world, a much younger person, and that would be Mel Torme.
Oh.
A very fine and controlled voice.
Now, what would you say is Ella Fitzgerald's, like, biggest hit? Did she have a hit, or did she have just a whole litany of material?
A litany is a series of prayers and entreaties to our Maker, so I don't think she ever did that. She did a lot of recordings with great big bands, like, for example, she did a lot with Duke Ellington, later on with Count Basie. She had been a big band singer, did a lot of solo albums, and was esteemed highly. She did a lot of duets with Louis Armstrong.
Oh, really?
Which are sort of funny because he has a somewhat different voice from the divine Ella.
They work, Satchmo, yes. It's you.
They work very well together. I have to say, my wife doesn't like popular music, doesn't like even like 20s, 30s, 40s music much. And what really turned her around was I started playing Ella Fitzgerald singing Cole Porter. And she changed her mind. And on an average night when I'm pouring martinis, she'll say, why don't you turn on some Ella?
Wow.
So she really is, she's very beautiful. She's one of the treasures of 20th century popular music.
Your wife or Ella Fitzgerald?
Both. I will say this about poor Ella Fitzgerald. Beauty of face was not given to her.
Oops.
And when you're as ugly as Ella Fitzgerald, men walk all over you.
Ella got a Davida,
yes, right.
Baby.
I'm
telling you, they have some connection there. It sounds right to me.
One of the reasons she could put across a sad Rodgers and Hart song is she spent a lot of sad time.
Oh, okay.
26.
Yes.
One of your favorite people, Rex, Marcus Aurelius.
Hey, I like that guy. I read those meditations. I've been reading them for a long, long time.
Profit from them. But he was born in 121 A.D., ended up being adopted by, and not adopted because he didn't have parents, but adopted because it was decided that he would be an heir to the imperial throne. And so Antoninus Pius became his stepfather. He was a very serious student of philosophy, particularly Stoic philosophy, and he wrote his reflections or meditations written in Greek, which is a little strange, but it was, Greek was the language of philosophy more than Latin was. A lot of it was composed in the camps. It's very interesting, he'll say, written on such and such a day among the Quadi or among the Marcomanni. He was of poor health, a weak constitution, and yet he spent much of his life in the saddle and on the march, fighting the Germans very successfully. And if he had lived 10 more years, he would have probably postponed the German threat by centuries because he beat them back in virtually every engagement. And yet war was not something he wanted to be engaged in. He had no desire for military glory, but in his position as emperor, it was his job to defend the Roman people and not to do what he wanted. He is the ideal of a benevolent ruler who sacrificed his own happiness and self-interest to that of the Roman people.
So in the movie Gladiator, Maximus isn't really the hero. Marcus Aurelius is the strategic commander. Was he calling shots?
Yeah. Oh, yes, absolutely. These guys, well, they were trained up to be emperor. They were given full military training, and they were often in battle in their teens. His interesting philosophy is he takes Stoicism, which is a very self-denying religious
creed.
Kind of
pessimistic. You never really expect the best. You just kind of...
Well, you either are the best or the worst, and there's nothing in between, and that makes us all pretty much the worst. He changed it as a Roman because, on the one hand, he was Marcus Aurelius' philosopher, man who knew his philosophical duty, who pursued his interest in all the higher things. But then he would say, but as a son, I am so-and-so. As a brother, I am so-and-so.
The whole first part of the book is, owe this to this person, I owe this to that person.
And so he understood his position as a Roman and as a Roman emperor, and he went to his grave doing his duty.
The tranquility that comes when you stop caring about what they say, or think, or do. Only what you do. Not to be distracted by their darkness. To run straight for the finish line unswerving.
He might be one of those good guys to do as a hero or a villain, because didn't he give the Christians a big hassle?
No more than anybody else. He was not a persecutor. Persecutions took place in his reign, but they were sporadic, irregular, and not directed from the center. He didn't like them because he thought they were stubborn, ignorant, unwashed people, and they're presuming to challenge Greek philosophy. He wasn't a polytheistic pagan. He believed that there was one divine power overlooking the universe.
Well, thank God they were stubborn. Otherwise, we might not believe what we believe.
Yes.
All right, here we go. You're going to get this one. You're going to get this one. I'll give you two lines. To be or not to be. That's the first one. And the second one is, alas, poor Yorick. I knew him well, Horatio.
The first one is Jack Benny, right?
Oh!
The movie To Be or Not to Be, made by... No, it's obviously William Shakespeare. You know, if people are interested in what we have to say about Shakespeare, we did a whole summer school.
Yes.
And I suggest that they purchase the tapes by going... the download to go online
in
at
Fleming.foundation.
That's
a great idea. There's so much great information by Dr. Patrick, Dr. Frank Brownlow, and of course, Dr. Fleming as well. That was very interesting. Recorded excellently, strangely enough, and easy to listen to. Tons and tons of information. That is our gratuitous plug for those, but you'll enjoy them, I promise.
April 27th.
Yes.
One of my personal heroes, his name is Dragoljub Mihailovic. Huh? Most people know him, those who do know anything about him, Draža Mihailović.
Oh, yeah.
He was...
That's totally different.
Born 1893. He was, they say in the encyclopedia, he was a Yugoslav. He was a Serb nationally. He became the leading Serbian general of royal troops during the Second World War when the Serbs were being overrun by the Nazis, partly because the Allies dragged the Serbs into the war on the one hand, and on the other hand, didn't back them up, which was utterly to be predicted. Mihailović had to lead partisan soldiers, sort of like Francis Marion or Robin Hood, and he had to spend a lot of time fighting the communists who were being funded by Stalin. After the war, the communists took over. He was put on trial for treason for collaborating with the Germans. He confessed ad was executed. Now, you still read this in encyclopedias. In fact, Milo Vangelis, one of the leading communist leaders in Yugoslavia, it says in one of his memoirs, I went to him and I said, Raja, I know you love your country. Unfortunately, we're divided. Now, all you have to do is confess. We know you're not guilty of anything. You confess. We'll let you go. You could then play a part in reconstructing our country after the war.
Yeah, that sounds reasonable.
And the poor dope accepted it and they killed him.
Oh!
That is the real story.
Oh!
All right. On the 28th of April in 1892 was born one of the stranger and more impressive figures in 20th century popular American music, John Jacob Niles. He was born in Louisville, Kentucky. His mother taught him music and music theory, and he started collecting Appalachian ballads. Hmm. And he became one of the great ballad collectors and ballad writers. He started writing as a teenager. He went to work for the Burroughs Adding Machine Company, traveling around and collecting songs. He served in the air service during World War I. He was wounded. And he then pursued his musical studies. He wrote a lot of songs. For example, he wrote either just the melody or he rewrote the words of Black is the Color of My True Love's Hair. Here's one that was recorded by every folk singer in the 60s. Go away from my window, go away from my door. Anyway, I saw him live in Chapel Hill about 1970, 71. He came out in a silk turtleneck sweater and a long-tailed frock coat. On the one hand, you'd say, this man's crazy as a loon. You can't dress like that. He was the last real balladeer, a man with an ego as big as his talent. On the 29th of April, one of my favorite serious composers of the 20th century, Sergei Prokofiev.
Sergei.
He had all the regular music training at the St. Petersburg Conservatory. He became a kind of enfant terrible. Well, you know, he was a very modernist and a very aggressive in his early
terrible
stuff. Yeah, a terrible child.
Oh.
He did a lot of piano music. He was a very fine pianist. He had very large hands, and he could do a lot of very fancy stuff. He's most famous probably for some of his earlier works, like his second and third piano concertos. But he wrote many symphonies, and his fifth is still widely played, a very powerful work. And one of his last works was a rewritten cello concerto that he had taken, and he turned into a kind of, well, he called it a sinfonia concertante, therefore cello and orchestra for the great Russian cellist Rostropovich. Many people, my wife included, they hold their ears when they hear Prokofiev's dissonances. And then I'll play something like Peter and the Wolf. And then, or his ballet, Romeo and Juliet, or he did a lot of very lovely, sweet, appealing music right beside his more aggressive, modern. Somebody complained to him once. I remember reading this when I was about 19. Somebody complained to Prokofiev, you know, why is your music so uneasy and so angst-ridden? He said, listen, I'm writing in the 20th century. This is not a century of easy faith, of easy minds. It's a century of doubt and insecurity and violence. And his music reflects that. But I would say that in his best later works, like the Fifth Symphony and the work for cello, he raises it to such a height of intensity and beauty that it is something that, given a little effort, everybody can love Prokofiev.
Are you saying this is the guy that wrote Peter and the Wolf?
Yeah.
That's the guy.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
You see that Disney cartoon? That is an amazing cartoon. I love that. And they describe all the musical instruments and everything. That is a good cartoon. Here is another Willie. We've got another Willie in April. And his name, well, I think you're going to like him. He was kind of he has been a guy who has used herbal medicative, herbal medication.
He smoked dope until very recently.
Yeah.
He gave it up.
He gave it up, says you.
No, I mean, there was a big interview. Willie Nelson declared that finally, after all these years of being stupid on dope, that he'd given it up.
Wow, Willie Nelson gave up marijuana.
See, you learn something every day, Rex.
Top story, 1937, on the 30th of April, he was born. So many songs, a guy who seems he was very at ease being on the road and traveling with his friends, even on the road again, I might add.
There are many good things to like about Willie Nelson. One is he was a very fine songwriter. You know, Patsy Cline's great hit, Crazy, for example, was written by a very young Willie Nelson. He was a nobody. Of course, a lot of country music performers begin as songwriters. And he had a kind of quirky but lovely voice. His guitar technique is very clean, and direct. What I don't like about Willie Nelson is all the BS about the outlaws, how tough they were. They didn't like you shooting heroin at the Grand Ole Opry.
No, they didn't like
that. And so, people who were troublemakers, like Waylon Jennings and Willie, Grand Ole Opry is supposed to be for families. You can't let your family watch people like that.
Yeah.
And they whined a lot about it, and then they put out these, and Johnny Cash is another one in this vein, and then they put out these albums, The Highwaymen, The Outlaws, all of that. Self-glorification and self-dramatization.
It's an image.
I leave that to teenage girls, not to grown men. By the way, I happen to like both Willie Nelson and Waylon Jennings a great deal.
I'm crazy. Crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy. Crazy for feeling so blue. I knew you'd love me as long as you wanted. And then someday.
Another great Southern writer.
Okay.
Born in Pulaski, Tennessee. John Crow Ransom. His father was a Methodist minister, and Ransom went to Vanderbilt, which he helped to make famous. He ended up teaching at some little schools, then he went to Oxford. Back at Vanderbilt teaching literature, he became the guru to a group of young writers who were writing poetry. And in fact, they sort of dragged Ransom into writing poetry, as I recall. They were known as the Fugitives.
Fugitives with the guru.
The Vanderbilt Fugitives. They wrote it because they had a little journal called The Fugitive. And later on, some of them, namely people such as Donald Davidson, John Crow Ransom, Robert Penwarren, put together a book called I'll Take My Stand, 1930, if I'm remembering correctly. And I'll Take My Stand was a manifesto of 14 Southerners in defense of the Southern cultural tradition.
Oh.
It became an enormously influential book, not just among Southerners, but in general. And later on, some of the same people went on to participate in a book called Who Owns America, done with with people like Hiller Belloc, the English distributists. These people all believed in the free market, but they didn't like capitalism. They believed in the Southern tradition, but they didn't especially like the rich upper class that dominated it.
Southern tradition, what would that incorporate?
The Southern tradition goes back to early colonial times. That is, the South had its own culture. It produced such people as Edgar Allan Poe and Mark Twain, know, and then later on William Faulkner, although the agrarians didn't especially get along with William Faulkner. It is one of the great and important strands of American literary and intellectual life. And Ransom, for a while, was sort of the eminence grise. Later on, he took a job at Kenyon College and became the first editor of the Kenyon Review, which for many years was a very distinguished American literary publication. There are no distinguished literary publications in America today.
Okay.
Let me read one of his most famous poems.
Yes.
This is In the Piazza, and it's a dialogue between a man and a woman. I am a gentleman in a dust coat trying to make you hear. Your ears are soft and small, and listen to an old man not at all. They want the young men's whispering and sighing, but see the roses on your trellis dying, and hear the spectral singing of the moon. for I must have my lovely lady soon. I am a gentleman in a dust coat trying. I am a lady young in beauty waiting until my true love comes, and then we kiss. But what gray man among the vines is this, whose words are dry and faint as in a dream? Back from my trellis, sir, before I scream. I am a young lady in beauty waiting. It has many of the qualities of Ransom's poetry, which are delicacy and indirectness, and he's often very puzzling, but very beautiful.
Crazy for thinking that my love could hold you. And I'm crazy for trying, crazy for crying. And I'm crazy for loving you.